Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. It's not so easy to find a rousing endorsement of TV news these days. Ever smaller numbers of us are using it as a primary source of information, and those who do watch are often dismayed by the amount of silly or sensationalized content wedged between the hard news. So whatever happened to the good old days when TV delivered reports that really mattered? And did the network bosses kill the serious content, or did we, the viewers? Charles L. Ponce de Leon is professor of history and American studies at California State University, Long Beach. He explores the development of the form in his new book, That's the Way It Is, A History of Television News in America. Charles, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
So infotainment is in fact not a recent invention or even one that originated with broadcast media.
Well, it actually has very long roots and you can trace it, to the mass circulation press and newspapers in the 1800s. From the beginning, commercial newspapers seeking an audience included news as well as features that were entertaining. It's been a convention of journalism almost for 200 years.
And it makes some sense that along with things that might be sort of difficult to process, you want a little bit that is kind of sweetens the package, I guess.
Absolutely. And it's imperative to couple news with entertaining features became more and more important as newspapers sought a wider readership. So it's sort of built into the commercial logic of the way that commercial news media work.
Why do we have TV news in the first place? It's expensive to produce. It never has been as popular as, say, sitcoms or dramas.
Well, that's a good question. And, you know, in the course of writing my book, I would often engage in these seemingly absurd counterfactual exercises where I would think, well, why on earth did they do this? Because it seemed, number one, that there were so many obstacles. In the early days, there were tremendous technological obstacles. But the big reason that TV news emerged, and this was true of radio news too, is largely because of the public service, public interest requirements imposed by the FCC. Now, the FCC, to be sure, were never a particularly strict regulator, but they did ask and then demand that that broadcasters serve their communities, and it seemed easy and logical for broadcasters to include news and view that as part of their public interest requirements.
I was fascinated to read here that the earliest producers of TV news reports assumed that everybody in the audience had already read a newspaper and that they were just there really to add moving pictures.
Yeah, well, that was a pretty safe bet in those days. Newspaper consumption was widespread, especially in the 20th century, the first half of the 20th century. People listened to the radio, often to hear a breaking news bulletin, but most people read newspapers, and most newspapers, the most widely read newspapers were those catering to a very broad, mostly working class audience. So the tabloid newspapers, basically, and so people were used to turning to print, and those papers went through multiple editions over the course of the day, and that was their way of dealing with stories that were ongoing. And so people, when they did turn on the television in the late 40s and increasingly in the 50s, it was a pretty safe assumption that they had, at the very least, glanced at a newspaper.
How did the precedent, Charles, of radio news broadcasts influence the way early TV news developed?
It's kind of tricky because in many respects, television broadcasters, network broadcasters in particular, were sort of eager to build on the prestige that the network radio broadcasters had earned largely during World War II. But radio successful network radio broadcasters were reluctant to jump into TV. And so the original producers of TV news actually came mostly from other fields. And in doing so, they brought a number of different techniques and traditions with them. So when the radio broadcasters, and here I'm thinking mostly of people like Ed Murrow and those distinguished people who eventually became fixtures on TV, when they finally went over to TV, there were these other traditions. And so TV news by the mid-50s became a very interesting melange of techniques derived from newsreels, from photojournalism, from print, and from radio.
What surprised you when you went back and started consuming, I guess, a great deal of old TV news broadcasts? What happened when you watched a show like See It Now, for example?
I was struck by a couple of things. Shows like See It Now I found to be, on the one hand, really expertly produced, considering the very limited technology. I mean, I was and very, very well written and edited, superbly done. I mean, it was clear that those kinds of programs had a lot of resources for the day, and the people who made them took their responsibilities very seriously. On the other hand, what was very striking about See It Now, for example, was the ways in which really from the beginning, serious, meaty stories were always juxtaposed with lighter ones. So again, even a program like See It Now, which of course is regarded, as the kind of lodestar of quality television broadcasting, even that kind of a program, at least in part, imported some of those features of mass circulation journalism that were designed to be entertaining, from the beginning imported those into the program. And I was surprised at that. I expected it to be a more consistently serious broadcast, and it was serious, but there were these other stories that were quite different from what I expected.
Were you able to get the bottom of whether the people producing this content, who put the serious, meaty, in-depth stories alongside maybe shorter sort of kicker stories, as they're sometimes called, did they assume that these were two groups of people watching them, or that the people watching the serious content also had a soft spot for the lighter stuff?
Well, I think a little of both. Television broadcasters really from the early to mid-50s were aware that their audience was pretty diverse and they couldn't have too much of any one thing. And that's also, was common in print journalism. And so they recognized the diversity of the audience and there needed to be sort of things for everybody or for as many viewers as possible. Certainly in a case like See It Now, there was a sense that even viewers who preferred serious stories also liked some of this other stuff. So I think they appreciated both aspects.
It's remarkable to think about some of the people who sort of throughout the course of the second half of the 20th century maintained influence on what TV news really was. For one, Don Hewitt seems to have been everywhere in the beginning and right up through the end of the 20th century.
Yeah, well, I realized that when I was looking over compiling and copy editing my index, how many references there were to Don Hewitt and how long. And Don Hewitt didn't just appear in places. I mean, he really was a formative figure any number of different times. His role in conceiving the earliest ways of visualizing news, in other words, creating news programs for a visual media, were actually revolutionary. His role producing and overseeing documentaries was important. So too, as everyone knows, or most people know, was his role in conceiving 60 Minutes, which in fact he quite explicitly regarded as a kind of anti-documentary. In other words, a way to deal with serious stories and present news in ways that people might actually watch, because the track record of documentaries in terms of attracting viewers was dismal.
It is interesting, though, there was a time when television documentaries were not so unpredictable. I mean, you could imagine that they would happen and that the network would produce them. You know, I'm thinking of something like Edward R. Murrow's Harvest of Shame, which, if I have it right, was broadcast like on a Thanksgiving night, which now it seems like would be programming death for any network that tried to get away with that.
Yeah, well, there was a brief period in the early 60s when mostly because of political pressure from the FCC, the networks grudgingly agreed to produce and, more importantly, broadcast documentaries. And so it was probably a 3-year period when they were most visible during prime time. The habit before this period, like in the late 50s, was to broadcast them on Sunday afternoons when, of course, nobody was watching or very few were watching. And so there was a brief moment when documentaries appeared on primetime. But, of course, it ended when the FCC sort of turned to other issues and more importantly, when, you know, the Johnson administration, which were both the Kennedy and Johnson administrations were committed to making television more in the public interest. When the Johnson administration became involved in its domestic agenda and then in Vietnam.
During that short golden period, and of course it wasn't like it was all hard news then either, but another advantage was that there just wasn't a lot of competition out there. There was no cable, there was no internet, there were, you know, for a lot of people in a lot of markets across the country, 3 or maybe 4 choices on any given day or night to turn on the television.
Yeah, and that's the big reason that so many people watched the evening newscasts. The Nielsen ratings for the documentaries were always terrible. So what happened in those days was when one of the networks would show a documentary, and usually the time of these was, you know, like on a Friday night at 10 o'clock or 10:30, people would just turn their TVs off rather than watch. They had terrible, terrible ratings. But insofar as anybody watched, it was because there weren't choices. I mean, most markets in the United States, so most cities, that's what I mean by markets, had few stations. Most had, you know, during the 60s, no more than 5 or 6. So there was the 3 networks plus a couple of independent stations reliant principally on reruns and old movies and amateurish local productions. And so there just wasn't a whole lot to watch. And so somehow, you know, for the lack of alternatives, people would sit through programs that if they had their druthers, they probably wouldn't watch, although in most instances the ratings suggested people just turned their TVs off.
Charles L. Ponce de Leon is my guest. He's professor of history and American studies at California University, Long Beach. His new book is called That's the Way It Is, A History of Television News in America. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Professor of History and American Studies at California State University, Long Beach, Charles Ponce de Leon. His new book is called That's the Way It Is, A History of Television News in America. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Charles, you had the networks trying to figure out what news should be, where to put it, where to, how to pay for it, how to schedule it. You also had local stations around the country producing not only news, but a surprisingly wide variety of like local programming in the early days.
Yeah. I mean, local news is an important part of the story. It's often neglected and treated as a separate, even, you know, inferior entity. But in fact, most of the innovations that have changed television news and have made and made television news more appealing to viewers originated with local news. So it's a very important part of the story. And I have to say that was one of the more surprising things that I learned in the course of my research.
What were some of those innovations that started at the local level and then spread to the networks?
Well, I think probably the most important was encouraging anchors and reporters to be more relatable to viewers and encouraging a selection of stories that were designed to be useful and interesting and even entertaining to viewers, and this was one of the most important features of network television broadcasting in the 60s was a quite conscious disdain for producing things that broadcasters knew viewers wanted. And so, there was a real obsession with what was called professional news judgment. In other words, journalists, producers deciding what were the most important stories were and the appropriate ways of covering those stories. And the idea was in many ways to mimic the serious, sober, analytic style of journalism associated with newspapers like the New York Times and the Washington Post. It was a kind of aspirational model of journalism. And local stations pioneered a very different kind of news. And the reason is that they, in the early 60s, were forced by the FCC to do some research and conduct these surveys to determine if they were meeting their local requirements in terms of providing for their viewers. And so they hired consultants to do all this research, and the results of the research about a lot of things, all kinds of programs that local stations aired. And these were, I'm talking, were in large part network affiliates. And what they found is that viewers didn't like network newscasts and network news programs. They found them boring. They didn't like the aloofness and sense of detachment displayed by anchors and correspondents. They didn't like the emphasis on international news and other sort of serious issues. And local news was crafted in part to be different from that. And what they discovered, what local broadcasters discovered, is that their local news programs could draw more viewers than the networks with their programs, which often appeared right after. In other words, people would watch local news and then turn off the network news, which followed it. And so as people who had apprenticed in local news were bumped up to the network and assumed positions as journalists, as producers, as executives at the networks, some of those innovations made their way to the networks and with profound consequences.
I want to play for you a cut here that is from the local ABC affiliate WFAA in 1963, and you'll hear in just a moment why it's significant to local history but also to national history. This is the Julie Bunnell variety show that was like a noonday program, and then there's a cut-in with local news.
Then there's zippers up the side so that the jacket will fit tightly around the hips, keeping that straight, sleek look that it should have. And very often you'll find a zipper hidden in the arm.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You'll excuse the fact that I'm out of breath, but about 10 or 15 minutes ago, a tragic thing, from all indications at this point, has happened in the city of Dallas. Let me quote to you this. And you'll excuse me if I am out of breath. A bulletin. This is from the United Press from Dallas. President Kennedy and Governor John Connally have been cut down by assassin's bullets in downtown Dallas. They were riding in an open automobile when the shots were fired. The president, his limp body carried in the arms of his wife, Jacqueline, has rushed to Parkland Hospital. And if you'll excuse me if I give some directions and we talk about what we're going to do here for the next few minutes, but Bobby, let's tape this, if you please, particularly the interview with the eyewitness people. It is being taped good. Here's a piece of copy that was rushed to me and was torn off from the United Press in Dallas. President Kennedy has been shot in Dallas, Texas. He was shot as a motorcade left downtown Dallas. Mrs. Kennedy jumped up and grabbed the president. She cried, oh no, as the motorcade sped on. An Associated Press photographer, James Algens, 8LTGENS, reports he saw blood on the president's head. The AP man said he heard two shots but thought someone was shooting fireworks until he saw the blood on the president.
That was WFAA's Jay Watson cutting into the lunch hour program on WFAA Friday, November 22nd, 1963, to report that President John F. Kennedy had been shot. I don't know whether you've heard that clip before, Charles. Maybe you can just give me your impressions, what you hear in that that might be indicative of the time. Obviously, it was a very extraordinary and tragic day for the United States. But is there something about that that sort of speaks to the urgency, maybe less polish in local news that people found appealing?
Well, you know, yes, but I think that was such an extraordinary moment. And people at the networks were doing it by the seat of their pants. Mm-hmm. I mean, so I think that they were running around and out of breath in New York at network headquarters as well. And at the same time, a couple of things struck me as really interesting in that. And one was his reference to taping it, because what he's referring to is videotape. And this was the period when videotape was beginning to be introduced. And it made the filming of things and the quick transmission and broadcast of film footage much easier than when 16 millimeter film had to be processed, and so that also contributed to the immediacies, the ability now to show things, if not while they were happening, then very soon afterward, you know, made possible by, you know, by videotape. So I think what you hear that in that clip, what I heard, because obviously I didn't see it and I haven't seen it, is the really exciting feature about television news, and that's that capacity to sort of take you there. And it was only a few days later when an NBC news crew captured Jack Ruby shooting Lee Harvey Oswald. You know, and that and NBC was the only one that had their cameras on at the time. The other two networks were able to show that very quickly afterward by virtue of tape, you know. But so, you know, here a new technology allowed viewers to really see something very quickly after it happened and to gain a real visceral sense of immediacy from that.
It is strange, and of course we're moving forward quickly in history here, that the dawn of 24-hour news programming, once we had cable fully in place, seems to have given way to less substantive content. It would seem like without the limitations of, you know, a 30-minute broadcast or a 60-minute broadcast, you could really get to the meat of things, and that's often not been what's happened.
Well, it seemed like it might, because one of the problems with a news on commercial broadcasting is that it always was a sideline, and this was much to the chagrin of the broadcasters, you know, the broadcast journalists at the networks, because they took what they did very seriously. And by the late 70s, in terms of technology and their aspirations and the quality of many of their programs, they were doing a very good job. But at the same time, they found themselves with less and less airtime. So suddenly, the prospect of cable and the trend in cable, which began early on towards specialized channels, seemed like a lifesaver. Because, you know, especially with CNN, you know, you had, there was no worry that you were bumping more profitable and appealing entertainment programs off the air. You could continue with a story. You didn't have to go back to your regular programming. News was regular programming. And that was very exciting to journalists. And a lot of people who went to work for CNN in the early years were excited by that feature. The problem is that people only watched CNN, or a lot of people only watched, when something big happened. And so under normal circumstances, the audience was very low. Especially when CNN began to attract competitors, the concern was, well, how do we get more people to watch on a more regular basis? Because other than big blockbuster stories, people weren't watching, and so cable news then changed in ways that cable news broadcasters hoped would make people more regular viewers. And of course, the most successful formula for that was conceived by Roger Ailes at Fox News.
And by that formula, you mean a mixture of programming that is just news and also a great deal of talk and news analysis?
Yeah. Basically, rather than casting a net widely and reporting on the great variety of things occurring in the world, focusing on stories that your research has determined appeal most to your audience and who you want to be your audience. So it's a kind of narrowing, and then following those stories pretty consistently over the course of the day, or sometimes for weeks. So in fact, there's a lot going on in the world, but cable news actually, sadly, despite the fact it's on 24/7, gives us very little sense of that diversity of subjects and of things that might be explored.
Should we blame ourselves for this, Charles?
Well, there were times when I was doing research and writing the book when I would sort of come to that depressing conclusion. And the fact of the matter is that people, there's a lot going on in the world, and it takes time and effort to keep up, especially if you want to know about some of these things in detail. And you can now because of access to the internet. So it's actually possible. There are resources out there to know a lot about what's going on, which is really neat. But it takes a lot of time and it takes a lot of work. And most people, and I have to include myself in this, you know, are unwilling to do that. And there's so many other things to do, to watch, you know, there's so many other things competing for our leisure time. And so, insofar as we're to blame, it's, I suppose, because more often than not, we succumb to the more attractive, pleasurable options.
I want to talk about the influence of, for lack of a better word, stars in television media. Let's listen first to Walter Cronkite's last broadcast.
This is my last broadcast as the anchorman of the CBS Evening News. For me, it's a moment for which I long have planned, but which nevertheless comes with some sadness. For almost two decades, after all, we've been meeting like this in the evenings, and I'll miss that. But those who have made anything of this departure, I'm afraid, have made too much. This is but a transition, a passing of the baton. A great broadcaster and gentleman, Doug Edwards, preceded me in this job, and another, Dan Rather, will follow. And anyway, the person who sits here is but the most conspicuous member of a superb team of journalists, writers, reporters, editors, producers, and none of that will change. Furthermore, I'm not even going away. I'll be back from time to time with special news reports and documentaries, and beginning in June, every week with our science program, Universe. Old anchormen, you see, don't fade away. They just keep coming back for more. And that's the way it is. Friday, March 6th, 1981. I'll be away on assignment, and Dan Rather will be sitting in here for the next few years. Good night.
Despite what Walter Cronkite implored, Charles, a lot of people felt as if when he left, things were never quite the same.
Well, that his leaving roughly coincided with the steep decline in the numbers of people watching not just the CBS Evening News, which was his program, but the other two network newscasts. So that's when in part, it's a coincidence. It's not Dan Rather's fault by any means. And the reason for that is competition from cable. Cable television stations that showed reruns of Star Trek during the very hour when the networks broadcast their news programs, and many people preferred to watch Star Trek even though they were reruns. Cable not only made it possible to see new channels, MTV, ESPN, HBO, it also enabled people to see existing UHF stations more clearly because everything came through a wire. Previously, like when people watched TV over the air, terrestrial television, and it came through an antenna, the UHF stations, the ones above 13, were inferior. The quality was inferior to those on the VHF band, which were 2 through 13. And so there was a great advantage if you owned a broadcast station, whether you were a network affiliate or not, and you were in that VHF band. All of a sudden with cable, they all look the same, UHF, VHF, cable-originated stations. Created competition. And so by the late 80s, early 90s, fewer and fewer people were watching the CBS Evening News or the other evening newscasts, and that decline continued inexorably.
Charles L. Ponce de Leon is my guest. He's professor of history and American studies at California State University, Long Beach, and author of the new book, That's the Way It Is, A History of Television News in America. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372 or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
We've even stuffed the CNN suggestion box with our constructive criticisms. I can't count the number of brilliant rebranding ideas we've thrown their way.
CNN, the most trusted name in over-caffeinated control freaks.
The human centipede of news, which explains CNN's new slogan.
CNN, we're all like, I know.
We're like a ghost network. Doomed to roam the airwaves with no idea what we're doing for all eternity. You're not even news anchors anymore. You're just news VJs. I love brunch. Who doesn't love brunch? That's news. It's great branding. Way better than CNN's. If you're watching this, your flight's been canceled.
Please, God, someone help me find the remote. The TV's stuck on CNN and I can't change the channel.
Come on, man, seriously, you can tell me it's CNN. No one's watching.
This is CNN.
That was a supercut of Jon Stewart's CNN Putdowns on The Daily Show. You're listening to Think on KERA. And my guest is Charles Ponce de Leon, He is professor of history and American studies at California State University, Long Beach. His new book is called That's the Way It Is, A History of Television News in America. Okay, Charles, Jon Stewart, it could have been Fox, it could have been CNN, it could have been any of the networks. Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert will both tell you they are not journalists, they are not analysts, they are not critics, they're just comedians, and yet they're a lot more than that.
Yeah, they most certainly are. I was laughing when I heard some of those clips because I mean, he's spot on about people not watching CNN and the absurd lengths to which CNN and the other cable networks have gone to attract viewers. And you know, the thing about it is it's actually opened up the terrain for Stewart in particular, you know, because Stewart, you know, his program is very, very funny. He's interviewed all kinds of different people, but in the course of the program, in the course of some of those interviews, he's really had occasion to really fill a void that appeared when the cable news channels went off in the direction that they did in the early 2000s of focusing on fewer stories tailored for your target audience, and then in the evening in particular. Putting on people who express opinion, you know. And so there was a real void that appeared in terms of addressing issues. And, of course, with The Daily Show, the big issue was the whole Iraq war. And there was a consensus in the mainstream media and on television in particular, you know, with the cable news channels to not raise that many questions and want to be good team players. And it was Stewart who sort of saw that and called it out and gained a lot of credibility himself for doing that. And that in turn has allowed him to do that with regard to lots of other issues.
You say that the release of the Abu Ghraib images was really what turned the tide of overall TV coverage of that war.
Yeah, that was, you know, there were always rumblings of discontent. There were always questions raised, but they were muted. And you know, the big problem, and I'm not the one who first saw this. I mean, political scientists have written about this, journalists have written about it. Where, you know, if you don't have official, you know, important officials, people attached to important institutions, important sources for journalists. If you don't have those kinds of people raising fundamental questions, they don't get asked, and they're not addressed in the media. The media will just sort of parrot the prevailing opinions, and if they're largely consensual or there's little difference between the two sides, that's what they'll run with, and that's what happened. In the wake of 9/11 and during the Iraq War, was just this sort of enforced consensus and muted questions and it was that story and other stories like it that gradually you know, the dam burst, and then all of a sudden people were asking all kinds of questions, and the entire legitimacy of the war all of a sudden was in peril.
Prior to that time, you describe the Bush White House as engaging in what is tantamount to programming of the coverage of the Iraq War, particularly with regard to things like the program to embed American journalists with U.S. forces on the ground.
Yeah, President Bush and his advisors learned a great deal from the ways in which previous wars had been televised. And, you know, were acutely conscious of ensuring that they had the media, reporting from the right script. And it helps to have seen what happened in Vietnam, which, of course, was an uncensored war. And then to see the difference with the first Persian Gulf War, which was more successfully managed in terms of ensuring that television coverage was in line with what the administration wanted. This would be the senior Bush administration, and you know, they learned a lot, and they're actually very, very smart people who figured out how to take advantage of the conventions of news gathering and the particular ways in which the television networks in particular and cable news were relying on pictures. So part of that is the ability to just overwhelm the viewer with arresting images. And then in terms of analysis, offer largely military expertise, you know, this rotating panel of the same military experts. And so not as wide a range of sources who might have questioned the overall strategy or the aims of the war as they could have.
The Bush administration also requested, it didn't try to absolutely ban, I don't believe, that no footage be broadcast of body bags and coffins of war dead. And the explanation was respect for the dead and for the grieving process of loved ones, which may very well have been part of the motive, but you suspect there was another motive as well.
Well, that's one of the most visceral images that people still have of Vietnam were all the body bags and all the coffins. I mean, any good documentary on the 60s now, especially television in the 60s, has its standard stock footage of body bags and coffins. Certainly the Johnson and Nixon administrations, you know, came to perceive that as a liability, as hurting them. The Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration, just absorbed all these lessons of how coverage of war and of all kinds of things they did not want to lose the plot, lose the narrative, and that meant being very savvy about what to allow broadcasters to film and show.
We have a tweet here from Max who says, when I was a little kid, the national news went from 15 minutes to 30. How did that happen if the audience didn't really want it?
It happened because of this pressure from the FCC and pressure from network journalists who were always eager. They were always pressing for more airtime. And again, the FCC licenses individual stations and demands that they that their broadcasting be in the public interest, and the understanding was that meant news and to a degree public affairs. And so network journalists now with more advanced technology at their disposal were eager for more airtime. They argued rightly that 15 minutes was hardly enough time. They pointed to public opinion polls that showed that more people were getting their news from TV than from newspapers. That tide had begun to turn in the 50s as newspapers began to lose circulation. And more importantly, more and more people were watching TV. And so journalists played their hand aggressively, saw the right opportunity, and pressed for a 30-minute evening newscast.
Another tweet from Stephen asks if you would discuss the fairness doctrine as it relates to TV news.
Well, that's a very good question. The fairness doctrine originally compelled broadcasters to present both sides of an issue, and it's the big reason that in the United States, we didn't develop a strong tradition, at least in broadcasting, of advocacy journalism, because if you advocated for something, then you then left yourself open to someone objecting to get equal time. And equal time meant time that might be given over to paying programming. And so that was, in many respects, a straitjacket on the broadcasting of opinion, and it was a very powerful motive for the project of trying to be reasonably objective. And then, of course, in the 1980s, the fairness doctrine was repealed, part of a larger wave of deregulation that occurred in a lot of industries and was particularly important in broadcasting and communications. And so that really opened up the airwaves, both radio and TV, to opinion mongering, and it made possible the opinion shows that now prevail on cable TV. They made possible the highly opinionated radio programs that now are so popular with viewers or listeners, rather. So it changed the landscape of broadcast news in important ways.
You call it an open question whether something as important as news should be determined entirely by market forces. Do you think American viewers literally don't know what's good for them?
Well, they know what's... Look, they...
They don't want what's good for them.
They're things they like. They're things they like, and they're... And I think most people do the best job that they can learning about things that they feel are important. But part of what's going on in America today, and has been for several decades, is a kind of disregard for feeling like you should know a lot. You know, I mean, it's hard to describe, you know, I mean, because people do know a lot about certain things, you know, and that's encouraged by our media environment. It's encouraged by the internet, you know, so it's not as though people don't know things and they don't want to know things. They know a lot of things and they're deeply curious and interested about other things. But one of the virtues of newspapers, for example, is that, you know, newspapers, and this is true of their online versions too, you know, there's lots of different things there that you can look at. That doesn't mean you do, you know, so it's possible to only read certain things in a newspaper. So just because you have access to it doesn't mean you necessarily know everything that's going on or everything that it's printed or published or posted. So, you know, I think... I don't want to despair, and I don't want to suggest that people just don't want to know or don't care, but there's certainly not a lot of powerful forces in the culture that make people want to be informed about things they're not already interested in.
Hmm. Do you think that TV news will last into the next decade? I mean, in a strong form? Is there any chance it'll come back?
Well, it certainly won't come back. I mean, everything is moving over to the internet, which, in my view, is a good thing, because the internet has all the best virtues of television, the capacity to present live events, you know, the immediacy of that, along with the best virtues of print, you know, where you can read things in detail. You've got graphics. You've got all kinds of things you can link to it. I mean, it really is a wonderful or potentially wonderful resource for learning about the world, things you're interested in, as well as things maybe you ought to know to understand really what's going on. So I think what we'll see is a kind of gradual movement away from news on TV toward news on the internet, in which some of the people and some of the forms familiar to us from broadcast television news will reappear, and they already have online.
Charles L. Ponce de Leon is professor of history and American studies at California State University, Long Beach. His new book is called That's the Way It Is, A History of Television News in America. Charles, it's been a really interesting discussion. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.